pasta sauce.
You have 10 quarts of pasta sauce.
Everyone gave us pasta sauce.
At the grocery shower?
From the grocery shower. We had 10 quarts of pasta sauce. And there are like 3 or 4 containers of Parmesan cheese. And over, we have like 380 13-gallon garbage bags.
You would think our church was full of Italian people.
That's what we thought. There's lots of lasagna and noodles. And spaghetti.
Welcome everyone to episode 2 of the Abstract Podcast, our podcast about ideas that matter. I'm Javen Bear.
And I'm Colin Steiner. And today we are here with Tristan Hertzler.
Hi, Tristan. Hey, Colin. Hi, Javen.
So, Tristan is a good friend of both Javen and I for years. You've probably known him longer than I have.
Many years. I remember you back from when we were in like second and third grade. You were a bad kid back then.
No. That can't be right.
A little bit. And then, I don't know what happened to you or me, but then we went to high school together. We've been friends ever since.
Mm-hmm. Tristan, you've been all over the place lately. You went to Asia how many years ago?
Almost four? It was 2016.
You went to Asia. Okay. Yeah. So you spent 9 months in Asia, right? Close.
Okay, I'm the worst person for recalling things, but I know it was 2016. I went to Asia and I got back 2017, 10 months later.
Okay.
So I left that the fall of 2016.
And then you went to New York to be a school teacher?
Mm-hmm. The end of that summer. So I was a teacher from 17 to 18.
And then you moved back to Virginia because your parents moved from here in South Carolina to Virginia.
Ooh, yeah, right before I went to New York. They moved to Virginia.
Okay.
And then I came home to them in Virginia. And then I worked there for a year and got my bank account out of the hole.
And then you got married. And now you're here with us. But you just went to Spain. Spain?
Yeah, Barcelona.
Italy.
Barcelona, Spain.
Spain. What was the coolest thing about Spain?
We were only in Barcelona, and I was there for the Mediterranean Sea. And it was a really great body of water.
So the Mediterranean Sea is a must-see.
Okay, I was explaining to someone the other day, but I couldn't remember what you were saying. Tell me about the little portions that come on top of the beer.
Oh, yes. Okay. So tapas is what they're called. And I think tapas literally means top or lid. And it started out, I guess there was lots of bars. Alcohol is huge in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would go to a bar to get a drink and it would come in a little plate on top of your glass. It could be any variety of
and complimentary,
foods.
Right?
Complimentary, yes. Mm. The drink was the expensive part. Now, you go and order tapas and you can get a cheap drink on the side. And we went for the tapas.
Dude, we should have tapas.
Tapas.
Mm-hmm. Tapas.
That could be the new sponsor instead of bread.
Hey.
Where do you get said tapas?
Okay.
Barcelona.
So today we're going to talk about some stuff. What do you got for us?
So we'll go through several different news stories. To go through. So we're going to talk about some Amishmen in Ohio. We're going to talk about Islamophobia. Ooh. We're going to talk about a shooting in Georgia, I believe it was. And then we're going to talk about a new clinical trial from, I think, Baylor University about bringing sight to the blind. That's really fascinating.
So good, bad, I forget, and good.
Yeah, yeah. We'll say bad. Shooting was the third one.
Yeah,
yeah, that's
not
bad.
It's not good.
The empathy runs deep. The other thing about today is September 19th. Yeah. And exactly 22 years ago today in 1997, singer, songwriter, poet that we have all, I think, enjoyed and benefited from his work, Rich Mullins, was killed in a car accident. And Mitch McVicker lived, but Rich died. In that, I think he was in his low 40s, if I remember right.
Yeah.
97.
Yeah.
Year. I was almost alive when he was alive.
Yeah, I was only a couple months old.
No, I was.
Yeah,
a few months. Yeah,
a few months. So no, Rich, yeah, I was introduced to his music. I think we probably all were by our high school teacher, Joe Mullet. Yeah. Probably a lot of us were. Just really like his, love his work. But did y'all have anything specific you think of when you think of Rich?
Oh God, you are my God.
Yeah.
That's all I can think of. That's what I knew him
by. Yeah, I kind of, in some ways, wish I would have been able to be around just for the CCM revolution. Mm-hmm. Like, just to be around, or to know what it was like before, like, From the Heart songs, worship was like a thing back when that was a new idea. And I was just thinking about this the other day. It's interesting to think about the songs that we listened to when we were kids. Was like, I mean, what I'm talking about, 6-7 years ago, the songs that played on the radio. Mm-hmm. And even like the songs now, it feels like, to me, limited perspective, that thing that kind of Rich and his generation or his people birthed of like this new creative way of doing worship music, it feels like it lasted until our early childhood and now has died off in terms of radio. Like when you listen to the radio now, you don't hear those songs. Mm-hmm. Last night we played worship at Lifeline and we played the Phillips Craig and Dean song, The Great I Am. Mm-hmm. And like just songs like that, like they're so distinct, and like you could never get that song mixed up with any other song. Like it's so distinct. And that's how Rich's songs were. Mm-hmm. And I just feel like that era of music has passed as far as radio play.
It really feels like what you hear on the radio, it's a straight up industry anymore. I mean, like,
yeah, definitely, yeah.
People want that so bad. It feels like there's trying to be like a rebirth of what you're talking about, like that Rich birth originally. It feels like there wants to be, like, people want that, but like there's just a sheer mass of music out there. There's just so much being produced.
Yeah, and I think we have to be careful. You don't ever want to say that Christian music has gone down the drain and it's all gone. It's just you have to go other places besides the popular radio to get it. Like it's all still out there, and it's probably more than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. But it's just interesting that his radio has moved away from what I would say is more creative style of music. Anyway.
Yeah.
We're grateful for Rich.
We are very grateful for Rich. And I think one of my favorite things is, I can say this now, we got in trouble for it a little bit back in the day, but my senior year, it was a little bit more of a relaxed schedule, especially the fall semester. And so I remember, Javen, you and I would be typing in the library doing our typing class. And we'd have concerts going on YouTube in the background to listen to. And a lot of yours were Switchfoot and a lot of mine were Rich Mullins, and we'd kind of listen to each other
on sometimes. On a closed Google tab.
But you pull it up every now and again to just kind of check it out. But just listening to, I listened to just several of his full concerts, and I don't know, a lot of people, I mean, they talk about he was the only guy that other bands would actually come back out just to listen to. But there's something, the depth of soul and how, he could connect things that I had never connected before. And I think it just captured his listeners then. And I think it's still capturing listeners now. And it's his music is timeless. So we're very grateful for that. We move from talking about Rich to, let's talk about Ohio a little bit. Let's talk about some Amish.
I was just in Ohio like 2 weeks ago.
You maybe saw these guys.
Probably did.
That's shirt cool. Pocket of America.
Yeah. Well, there's that. So I was really kind of curious. I would have loved to like find these guys' names, because I figure since we're all Anabaptists, we probably could have traced them back to our family lineages.
Probably better that we didn't.
Somehow. But I think we're quite fine with not taking any credit for knowing these readers too much. But anyway, so this is a report on CNN just a couple days ago. Picture this: two Amish men drinking alcoholic beverages while operating a horse and buggy, carrying a 12-pack of Michelob Ultra and outfitted with a giant stereo system. This is Trumbull County Sheriff's Department in Ohio. And that's what they witnessed during a routine patrol in the county's Amish community. Deputy Eric Hermsdorfer came across them.
Classic.
Yes. While on patrol early morning of September 15, when he attempted to stop and question them about drinking and driving, they leaped onto the buggy and disappeared into the woods by the side of the road, according to the police report. Meanwhile, the horse and buggy was startled by all this activity and took off, but Hermsdorfer caught up to it. The men, though, were gone. So what he did is he turned the horse and buggy loose. He said, at first, I think he, from what he understood, is that horses are like homing pigeons. I don't really know horses that much, but they'll go back to the farm they came from. So he figured he follows the horse and buggy. So he followed the horse and buggy for a while, but the attempts were futile. So he turned it over to a local farmer, and they figure eventually the two guys will come out and claim their horse and buggy.
Okay, my question is, are these guys really in the wrong? Because how much skill does it take to drive a horse safely? A car, you'll lose control and it'll kill you and other people. But a horse? I feel like horses drive themselves.
Well, that's, it brings up, you know, does, this brings up the question, though, does a horse count as a designated driver?
Right? The Amish literally always have the designated driver.
Like, I think there's a case to be made there.
I have a strong and harsh opinion. Horse and buggy should not be allowed. Like, it should be illegal to drive those on the road because they pose great risk to people in the buggies and the people driving around them.
But Tristan, they, that's so heartless. Yeah, you have to think Amish people as like, I mean, they were basically there before the land was there. So we can't just kick them out.
Oh, I know, it's heartless. It's selfish.
No, I was amazed that when I was in Ohio recently, even Walmart, like, I was just amazed at the way, like, the government has just, I don't know, made a little pocket for them to live their own little lifestyle right along with everyone else. Like, Walmart has a horse barn out beside the parking lot where you can hitch up your horses in Walmart. It's like, yeah.
Here in the Deep South, we do not so much have hitching posts.
No, but I did pass on 24 the other day. There was a horse and buggy there, but he had it. It was made, and it was, it had like this tarp over top of it. Like, it was a covered wagon, but it made it look like a big round hay bale. And then on the inside, he had like old seats from like a minivan or something bolted down. And so he was like, he was leaned back. He looked, it was two mules and a horse, I think, down the road. So
I was also amazed. You would see, we were sitting, we were staying in a house right by the road, and you would see horses and buggies cruising by, and like, they'd have music blaring, they have like lights flashing, like, I mean, it's not out of the question that these guys were totally wasted.
Springing the rum.
An old Bumscheldorfer brought him in.
Hermsdorfer.
We salute you.
Anyway, this story really has no meaningful significance except that I found it slightly humorous. Yeah. So,
moving on.
Like, the lost sheep have gone astray.
Yeah.
And there's always a Bumscheldorfer to bring us back.
Yes. So, we'll talk about more of the Islamophobia article more towards the end, and we'll just kind of throw around some opinions with that one towards the end. So let's jump to Georgia. Javen, you found this story.
Yeah. This is this is a sad story. Yeah, I'll read this here. Lawyer Mark O'Meara represented George Zimmerman in the fatal 2012 shooting of... Oh, I'm sorry. That's the wrong one. In Conyers, Georgia, neighbor Carlos Watson told WSB-TV that he heard gunshots at about 4 a.m. Monday morning. He says it was 5 shots, and then it sounded like a handgun. Then I heard somebody have an assault rifle, and it was a slew of shots. Neighbor Brian Jenkins told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution that he waited until deputies arrived before checking on the masked man lying in his yard screaming for help. Dang.
That's a little rough.
Anyway, I told him to just calm down and relax, he said. It will be okay, just stop moving.
So this was...
That's the end of the article. That is...
There's more about the beginning, I think. But so there was 3 intruders that... Like, the thing I was amazed... Like, the neighbors were out in their yard when they were... When these 3 masked men came to them, right?
Oh, yes. Here's more of the article. So the teens, ages 15 and 16, died Monday following an early morning exchange of gunfire with a resident. Evidence indicates the 3 teens attempted to rob 3 people in a front yard. Okay, who's in their front yard at 4 in the morning? It could be a stand your ground type of case based on the preliminary information that we have learned so far, Levitt said at a press conference. Levitt said the teens were wearing masks when they approached the yard and that one of them brandished a gun and reportedly fired shots at the resident. One of the intended robbery victims returned fire. The victims of the attempted robbery were not injured, but one of the teens died at the site and the others were rushed to the hospital where they died.
That is an awful story. Where was the intended victim shooting from? The yard?
I think just right outside the gate is what it sounded like.
Oh.
Man. But it doesn't say motive.
He was just armed.
What? It said attempted robbery.
Oh, attempted. Okay.
So, in my mind, it's 4 a.m. and three kids come up with a gun to someone's front yard and try to rob them. They're wearing masks. And from what I read, I'm pretty sure the kids shoot first.
Okay.
And then they return fire on...
With an assault rifle.
With an assault rifle. I also seen... Let me see if it's here in the article. When I first read it, it might have been on a different news source, but there was a sign in the front yard that said, like, no trespassing, violators will be. And then instead of prosecuted, it was taped out and it said shot. So I think this guy was prepared for an attack of this sort. But yeah, just like, you know, you have to wonder what makes three kids who are 15 and 16... want to show up in someone's yard with a handgun. That's not good.
Strange, no motive either. Or like there's...
Yeah.
4 a.m, it's very bizarre.
Very bizarre.
And you hope it's an anomaly.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to be.
Like, I wonder how much of these things happen because you read statistics in like some cities like Chicago or Detroit where like this is... It's... reality
nightly. And
they, yeah not like this to this extreme all the time, yeah, but
I mean that's nightly stuff
there. yeah
and coincidentally at work today Jeffrey said that he received a message from Phil Stossfus. Shout out Phil and Jeffrey. No, okay, anyways, I have no details, but like, you sent me this article, what, 2 days ago? A day ago?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, that's Georgia. That's not far away. And it sounds like, yeah.
Yeah, we actually, that's the reason I was able to come here early. Because we planned to do this at 8:30, because we had ministry, but we canceled it because there were gunshots last night over the Church of God of Prophecy.
At the church.
Yeah. So, yeah, rough. It's not far from home.
Like, it's not. Sure. And... like you're saying, you hope it's an anomaly, and it's like extreme brokenness, and it's painful, and but like you said, where does it come from?
Well, let's move on. Let's move from a little more depressing. Let's get a little more hopeful here.
Okay.
So we're moving on to Baylor College of Medicine. And this, when you read the headline, it sounds very Jesus-like. Bring sight to the blind. Jaden, you found this. Tell us what's going on in this article. I read through it, and I needed you to... This is the abstract podcast. I need you to give me the abstract of what was going on in this article.
Let me speed read and give you the abstract. In a dark room inside Baylor College of Medicine, study participants are asked to look at a blacked-out computer screen and point to a white square that appears at intervals on different locations on the monitor. The majority of the time, they can successfully point to the square, even though each participant has been completely blind for years. So I watched a little side tag video, and there was this guy who... Let me back up. To participate in the study, you can't have been born blind. So they want people who, for some reason, had sight and then went blind. And they do this implantive surgery. And he's, like, putting some sort of sensors or information sensors on the brain. And then I think they wear glasses. And it actually allows them to, I think, pick up shapes and lines. So, like, he's not probably seeing in, like, color and maybe not recognizing faces. But he talked about being at a bar and seeing the dots coming toward them and getting bigger as the waitress approached him. So, like, it allows them to go from receiving zero information from the eyes to, like, very small things. But those small things are enough to, like, walk around and function and see people, so...
They're completely bypassing the eye, though, aren't they? Just feeding information to the brain.
Yeah, that was what I thought. Because reading it, it's like it almost... It tricks your brain.
Yeah, that makes more sense.
Like it's something like it's electrical, right? So it's somehow.
Oh, right here. Okay.
I'm the worst person to try to explain.
For many years, we've been studying how the brain encodes visual information. When you think of vision, you think of the eyes, but most of the work is being done in the brain. The impulses of light that are projected onto the retina are covered into neutral signals that are transmitted along the optic nerve parts of the brain. In the future, we hope to use our understanding of how the brain processes visual information to develop a visual prosthetic that will restore useful vision to the blind. So, yeah, it's like you said, bypassing the eyes.
Okay, so it basically hijacks the brain, and you can at least, you can see enough to function.
Yeah, I think the device is what's sensing the information and feeding it without the eyes.
Without the eyes, actually.
Yeah. So you could leave your glasses on a table, and yes. If you turn your head, I mean, you're only seeing where your glasses are pointing.
If you do that thing where you put the like your hat and your glasses on the back of your head, you would have eyes in the back of your head. Mm-hmm.
So in reality, so this be comparable. It's essentially something similar to when you put on like virtual reality. Like it's like you're seeing it, but you're not actually there. Except but this, it feels real.
This feeds directly into your brain.
This feeds directly.
It was into like your if you brain. Had
okay
virtual reality, but you still kept your eyes closed.
And this is communicating reality to your brain.
But it's not necessarily color. It's shapes and
I think
lines
we haven't gotten to color yet.
Perception maybe of light. Okay. And dark?
That reminds me. Have you guys ever seen the videos where the people are colorblind and then the family like buys them the Google or whatever glasses?
Yes.
I've never actually watched those
videos ever.
So touching.
Yeah. Because it'll be like usually these older people and they'll put on the glasses and then for the first time in a very long time they'll see vivid color.
Instead and the of tears just black run. And white.
Yeah, and then they cry.
And they're overwhelmed.
Huh. Sensory overload.
And they yank the glasses off quick.
And hug everyone. And,
mm-hmm. and yeah. put them back on and are re-overwhelmed.
I want to go watch another one of those.
That is fantastic. And it sounds very, like, that sounds,
yeah,
kingdom-oriented. When you think of blind receiving their sight.
I wonder,
seeing color for the first time.
How many senses do we have?
Five.
Five senses. Maybe heaven will be, like, six or seven or eight. There'll be senses we don't know about yet. That'd be cool.
Yeah. Well, the thing I think is kind of cool is like the senses you do have are redeemed. So it opens up the potential that like you may not actually know what your favorite food is. You may have not tasted your favorite food yet.
Right.
Because you've not yet eaten redeemed food or tasted.
Redeemed food, yes.
Or tasted with redeemed taste buds.
Sure.
You may not have actually heard your favorite song yet.
Hmm.
You know, you so haven't heard with redeemed instruments.
Need to be praying for the redemption rather than the blessing of our food. But on a more serious note, I am thinking of like this. You said five senses. I'm like, what other senses don't we have because we live in a broken world, or simply because we are the created, not the creator? Like, what? I mean, you know, it's gonna happen. We're gonna have much more heightened sense of the presence of God. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like my senses are so limited to his presence, but like we'll actually be in his physical presence the way it sounds.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So I just want to, this completely blew my mind. The other day in class, we're talking about creation and what the fall meant. Mm-hmm. And so Professor Warner was talking about how man had dominion over creation. And then when the fall happened, that relationship with creation was broken. And so then God's like, when you try to grow stuff, it's not going to go so good. And you're going to grow thorns and thistles. You'll tell the ground to bear fruit, but it won't do it for you. And all this things broken. Mm-hmm. So he was asking, he was like, so what that means then is before the fall happened, when man truly had dominion over creation, if you told the ground to bear fruit, it would bear fruit. And if you told a tree to give you seeds or whatever, nuts, right? It would bear whatever. And then he said, and if you told it to rain, it would rain. If you told the clouds to go away, they would go away. And if you told a mountain to jump, it would jump. And then he said, in the New Testament, Jesus comes back as a portrayal of what man looks like when he has a relationship with creation that's not broken. And then Jesus stands on the boat and says, be storm. Still.
Yeah.
It's still. I just thought that just completely blew my mind.
Oh, man.
Blowing mind.
Yeah.
To smithereens.
Yeah, you have to sit back and digest that one a little bit. Oh, I think it's... Yeah. I just think of... it changes for me. It changes my imagination when I think of, like, when we think of it in that way, or you think of it in a way where it's something that you, like, we talk about senses. So it's something you sense. You are here. You can see. You can taste. You can feel. There's something physical.
You're talking about heaven?
No, right now.
Oh yeah.
So this stuff is all tangible. And the thing that's really gripped my imagination, especially in the last year or two, is that this is too big of a subject to get into too much, but when you think of the redemption of the earth as a physical thing, when you think of reigning with God on earth in a physical place, with when we're in the physical presence of God, whatever that looks like, whatever that means, and you think of us as the new Adams reclaiming the dominion over even, yeah, things like the weather and what that'll be like for our bodies, but it gives you at least a starting point for your imagination. If you don't have to think of it as another worldly place, mm-hmm. far away, but instead it's really not that far away, and it's groaning, and it's going to be here. And then it's we can still use our senses to perceive and all those things, even in the new creation. And that gives me an imagination. That gives me more hope, too. That makes me look forward to it more when I don't have to create a completely new planet, because it feels like when you create a completely new world, it's you all pool your ignorance on what this place is going to actually look like.
Yeah. You know, I remember being younger and always hearing about how when you die, your body stays here, but your soul goes on. And I was always like, man, that's kind of a bummer, because I don't know what my soul is. And I don't know if it's going to be able to experience, like, fun stuff.
Uh-huh.
But that's really not what the Bible says. These bodies are, like, recreated. And so I'm sure that we look incredibly different and better in the new creation, but I think I would still be able to recognize you.
Yeah.
At least I think it's not, I don't know. I don't think it'll be as different as just your soul flying away and mm-hmm. your body being here. Mm-hmm. And we're just souls out there up in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more real mm-hmm. than sometimes we make it out to be, I guess.
Mm. Yeah. And again, this is the abstract podcast. We're giving you our thoughts off the top of our head. Do not take us as very much authority. Go study these things.
I'm an authority on all matters.
We have Jamin. He's an authority on all matters. Don't listen to Tristan or I too terribly much. Go research these things. These things are the new creation's coming, and go stretch your imagination about it and go read good books about it. Listen to good people talk about it. Because it'll really gets you excited, I think. Anyway, let's move on.
I'm still stuck on the idea of not blessing my food. I'm going to pray for the redemption of my next meal.
Of our food, mm-hmm. so that it may further the redemption of our bodies.
Mm-hmm. I can fully taste it.
So that we, with our food, can join
taste
in the groaning
and see,
for right? the new creation.
Mm-hmm. Tasting is believing.
Tasting is believing. Taste and see the Lord.
We should make shirts that say tasting is believing. What do we got next?
All right, so this is what we're going to talk about last. Unless we find something else that we just really want to talk about. This is a new study. I found this really fascinating. This is an article from Christianity Today, written up by Jason Casper. I don't know him at all. But September 12th is when this one was published. But I found it just really interesting, and I thought it'd be... It's got 5 points basically to it from this new research that just came out about Americans, specifically evangelicals and Muslim relations, and how mm-hmm. the two view each other and how they're viewed in the public. And it's very, it's just a great article. So we'll talk about some, and we can talk about more once this article is done. I thought of it right away. We all kind of have the unique opportunity where we live close to Clemson University,
right.
where we have a large population of Muslim students come to Clemson University. It gives us a great chance for interaction. And so for me, it's super interesting. And I think for us, as we live in the place we live at, where we have the opportunity to interact and things like that, it's very timely and interesting to read this. So the headline is Evangelicals Who Distrust Muslims Likely Don't Know Muslims. And this is a 2019 survey shows how relationships curb Islamophobia and improve understanding between the two faiths.
I want to just say that I think relationship pretty much cures every phobia.
Yeah.
That's... I'm not just trying to be, like, facetious. Like, mm-hmm. for real, like, once you get to know anything, it's about easier to not be afraid of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Even spiders, probably.
Mm-hmm.
So this article, earlier this week, a Baptist church in Michigan canceled an event titled 9/11 Forgotten? Is Michigan surrendering to Islam?
Ooh.
And they canceled this due to pushback from fellow Christians and politicians.
Good.
The pastor of Bloomfield Hills Baptist Church identifies as an Islamophobe and organized the gathering because he sees Islam as a growing threat in the U.S., the Washington Post reported. So that's kind of the premise for why this article, why they published some of this stuff. But I think we could all kind of, you know, I mean, in my limited experience, I've definitely heard or read that voice that is terrified of Islam. And again, we just passed 9/11, so we want to be very sensitive with how we talk about this.
Like, I can see, for instance, young women identifying as arachnophobes and being afraid of spiders. But a pastor to identify as an Islamophobe, that's not, that's not cool.
Yeah. Anyway, so this is, so go through this article a little bit. It basically just highlights this new research that just came out, 2019 study. So back in 2017, there was a study done, maybe Pew Research maybe did it, I think. But they found that more than one third of evangelicals, so roughly 35%, knew a Muslim personally in 2017. And this was fewer than any other religious group, which honestly, once I saw 35%, I was actually...
Yeah, that sounds like a lot.
I was like, actually, it sounds pretty good. Because it's honestly, it's not... Especially if you live in a real rural part of the country, you're just... It's not that you are or you aren't an Islamophobe. You just, you're not ever going to run into any.
Or not be friends with any.
Right. Yeah. So this is some new... data, and it has, again, so let's put this at the beginning, has a high margin of error because it had a large sample size. And again, when you're categorizing religions, there are so many multiple subgroups in your main group, like evangelical, there's so many subgroups within that. So again, these are great generalizations, but I think they were interesting. So this is a study conducted by the Institute for Social Policy and Understanding, the ISPU. And they found several different things. So we're just going to kind of go through these. There are about 5 points that we'll just kind of talk through. So the first thing that we're going to talk about is the first finding of these studies is that white evangelicals lag behind in knowing and befriending Muslims, and Jews excel. So they asked this question to their audience, to their sample size, to their sample group. They said, do you know a Muslim personally? Evangelicals was 35% still. This is a 2019 study. Protestants were at 44%. The general public was 53%. The unaffiliated were 57%. I'm not quite sure what the distinction between unaffiliated and public is, but we'll leave that for now. 61% of Catholics and 76% of Jews said they know a Muslim personally.
Okay, they know a Muslim personally.
Yes. So evangelicals are about a little below half of how the Jews relate to them. Which, when I first saw that, it made me think Jewish-Muslim relationships, I would say, have been strained at best throughout history. You know, I think that's a safe...
Since pretty much forever?
Yeah. Okay.
But you think about where they live.
Right.
They live on top of each other.
Sure.
Like, okay, I had to think about that. I was reading over some of these statistics, and I was like... Where do Christians live? These evangelicals.
Wait, so this wasn't American Jews, obviously. It was all Jews?
This is in America.
I was thinking in America.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, where is a very large Jewish population?
New York City.
And Muslim population.
Yeah. Yes. Certainly.
And I mean, I don't know about evangelical population, but it seems like the Bible Belt is way down here.
Yeah.
But
so you're saying that Jews have a much more greater chance of knowing a Muslim, regardless of how they feel about Muslims.
Uh-huh.
Right.
That's a pretty good point.
I mean, you brought up Clemson, but there's Clemson only here.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, what about Nebraska?
And honestly, I mean, if you think of the next, like there's a place I know close to Atlanta for, there's a large Muslim population there, but you have to travel.
Mm-hmm. Also, as you go north and east, population density increases.
Right.
So like, we don't have near the population density down here.
Right.
So, I don't know. Probably the statistics might hold out.
Yeah.
But they could be. Aren't they supposed to control for that kind of thing in their research?
They didn't have much about how they conducted the research. Interesting. So I didn't research a lot what their research actually was like. But so that's observation number two or number one. White evangelicals lag behind. Again, this is not evangelicals, it's white evangelicals. That's the distinction they draw. So they lag behind in knowing and befriending Muslims. Jews excel. Are the statistics skewed? We'll leave that up for viewer discretion.
Listener discretion.
There will be no That's right. There's no video.
You can view the little thing that goes across your screen when it plays.
Yes. Two, most Muslims have a favorable or neutral views of evangelicals, but this is not mutual. So evangelicals don't necessarily have a favorable or neutral view of Muslims. So for Muslims, 50% of them said they had no opinion on how they favor.
They're indifferent.
Yeah, they're indifferent.
We said, what did we say about them? I will identify as an evangelical.
Yes, I will too. And there's.
Would you like to identify?
Well, yes.
Okay. So there was no percentage for no opinion, which I thought was strange. But so it just says 50% no opinion about evangelicals for Muslims towards evangelicals. 33% of Muslims feel favorable towards evangelicals. On the flip side, evangelicals, only 20% feel favorable towards Muslims.
Perhaps the important statistic to distinguish here is that we just have more opinions than Muslims.
That's what it sounds like to me.
We'll get to that in another observation. So 14% of Muslims are non-favorable towards evangelicals, and 44% of evangelicals are non-favorable towards Muslims. The general public is 21% is favorable towards Muslims, but it jumps to 47% if the general public knows a Muslim, and jumps to 57% if they're a good friend of a Muslim. So not too much of a
relationship.
Surprise. Relationship.
You know what I would be interested to know is what this looks like in terms of age brackets. Because in my limited experience, the older you get, the more likely you are to not like Muslims very much. But that could just be my experience.
Those are anecdotal.
This might be because of my Facebook feed.
Maybe. Looking at this makes me think there are people out there that fit my category, evangelical, I do not like them being in my category, because this seems really basic to me. I credit it to my high school education. But just realizing that not all Muslims are jihadist. And that's the main reason people, I would say, don't look favorably.
And that's what I kind of came away from reading this study. And we'll kind of get to it at the end. But it's like a lot of the people that are my friends, evangelicals, this isn't true of them. I would see them as some of the most hospitable people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, cool. Yeah, certainly.
Yeah. So that's what some of it didn't seem quite fair. Anyway, we got to quick move on. We'll push for time. White evangelicals and Muslims rank highest for piety. 82% of evangelicals
and Muslims
rank highest for piety. Okay. So 82% of evangelicals believe their religion is important to everyday life. Muslims, 77%. Evangelicals, 75% of them believe their religion brings meaning and purpose. 63% of Muslims and evangelicals, 63% of them believe it's important to forgive others, and Muslims, 54%, even when the wrong is egregious. So they, white evangelicals and Muslims, so very similar in ranking as far as how the general public sees them in piety rankings. Observation number four, I'll speed through these. Muslims report more religious discrimination, but evangelicals are more likely to say something about it. 62% of Muslims experience discrimination, according to the study, and 37% of evangelicals. When asked if they would take an unpopular stand to defend their faith, 78% of evangelicals said yes, Muslims, 56% of them. So,
interesting. I don't even know how that's quantifiable. Have you experienced, what was the?
Religious discrimination.
Religious discrimination.
That seems like such a large variety of a question to ask. I don't know. So we'll leave
that one.
What's
the last one?
Number five, white evangelicals want religious law more than Muslims want religious law. So this is thinking of religion as a main source or a source or not a source of U.S. law. That was the question. Mm-hmm. So for Muslims, 51% of them said not at all. They don't want their law.
Their law?
Or their law.
Like Sharia law?
Yes.
Well, I don't either. Yeah,
so
maybe we could
So 51% say not at all, and 33% said they did want it. For evangelicals, 27% said not at all, and 54% said they wanted it.
Interesting. Okay, quick quiz. Tristan, do you want it?
Take it.
Do I want what?
Yeah, do you want your religion to be integrated into U.S. law?
Oh, not really.
Okay.
I mean, integrated in what
Thanks
way?
Thanks for taking my quiz.
Are we doing an explanation? We'll leave it at just a multiple choice answer.
Now, that's a whole other.
Yeah. Well, anyway.
I agree with you, though. I want freedom.
So here, yes. There actually was, it was very similar when it came to, as far as viewing it as a main source of law. Only 12% of Muslims and 70% of evangelicals thought it to be a main source of law. So there was some, it was fairly similar there.
Interesting.
Anyway, but the baseline of the study then found that 24, this is where we're very similar, 24% of evangelicals and 26% of Muslims report relationships between the two groups, Muslim evangelical relationships, as poor. And basically what you can conclude from this study and from these statistics, whether or not they're skewed a little bit, it gives you a fairly clear picture that knowing a Muslim cuts the likelihood of a negative perception in half.
So make a Muslim friend.
So go That's make a Muslim friend. That's the moral of the story.
In recap, what was the first article?
We talked about Rich Mullins.
Rich Mullins, not with us anymore, but
we're glad for what he left
and
us.
We're glad that he was.
Yes.
Second one.
We have two Amish men still.
Yes.
Missing
Spring in action. The rum.
So keep your eyes open. Help the Rumsberger, whatever his name was.
Rumsberger is going to bring him in to justice.
He's our still Anabaptist on the cross. History is not over.
It's never over. And number three was the shooting.
Shooting in Georgia.
Yeah.
Very tragic.
Number four, we had the blind people receiving sight.
Yes.
And number five, we are trying to make Muslim friends so that we are not Islamophobes.
And towards the redemption of the world and redeemed food.
Redeemed food. I think that's the moral of the story. Okay. Thank you guys for listening to the second episode of this podcast. Tristan, thanks for sitting down and talking with us.
You're welcome.
This show was recorded in a room in Colin's house. It was produced by Ashton Cooper, our good friend and producer, and it was listened to by you.
And we do not have a loaf of bread for our guests, so we feel really bad about that, but my mom dropped off a plate of cinnamon rolls, and we are going to offer him a cinnamon roll. So it's a bread-like product. So yeah. we're gonna say that counts for this.
We're going to pray for its redemption and give it to you to eat.
Thank you.
Anyway, it tastes like redeemed food. It's very good. Yes. So thank you for listening. Thank you for being on, Tristan. And we hope y'all will tune in next time for episode 3.
Peace.